Okay, we'll get started in a minute. Here is a book review of Rav Shurla, Acharecha Narutza. We'll talk about it when we get up to the Daf Yomi Chadashim. We'll put it up on the web too of it. But you take a copy, it's an interesting, you'll get to really see where people, well, this was in a regular American journal. In a book review of Rav Shurla, we'll talk about it more when we get up to that thing, so the same. Okay, fine. I assume I'm going to have everyone's first draft of their paper by next week. I'm glad, or at least a week and a half before Pesach, so I can get through it. Excellent. I'm glad we're all on the same page. Okay. Varieties of responses to writing papers about orthodoxy. But no, I really do want them in. What was the last thing I said about Rav Aaron? Can anyone tell me? Just what I was up to? One of his. What was the last thing? What? Ethics. Okay. Let me continue with ethics. I must point out before I go on, since this is coming out as a book review, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein treated me to a long lunch 2 days ago to talk about, he already started skimming the first few pages, and he said the first correction he wants to make is that he was raised to be the path of yeshiva because of his mother. His mother learned in the Yavne school in Tells, and Chaim Bluch was a Ben Bayit. Remember his seven-year-old, him coming from Tells of Shabbos, and he remembers, you know, the present that Rav Kamenetsky gave him for his bar mitzvah. And it was, it's his mother's connections to Rav Huttner, that it was all his mother. In contrast, his father was a German rabbi doctor who had done an hour and a half of Gemara a week in his training. So he wanted to stand very clear on that point, that I understand the dynamics, and then I was then also treated to all sorts of his summer camp and school stories, which I have to figure out now what to do to preserve them. Yes. What? I'm going to do some of them. I have to judiciously say what's a correction and say Od Chazon L'Moed just to record it, because I spoke to someone from the Etzion Foundation who else, meaning, you know, all this stuff should be collected now that he's going around talking about it. Okay. Okay, we're dealing with the ethical statements. We're talking about, okay, so the last point is he holds from a theological suspension of the ethical when there's a conflict of ethics and halacha. So like many students of Soloveitchik, the theological suspension of the ethical has been expanded from one peak moment in your life fraught with fear and trembling and not having any normal context in your life, into now being globalized into a general halakhic category as something that applies on a continuous basis to the Torah worldview. Rav Aaron is certainly known for advocating secular studies, and already in 1961, he called for the need for synthesis from a Torah perspective, Torah point of view. What? General studies from a Torah point of view. Thank you. Right. General studies from a Torah point of view. Thank you. In which he opens the essay saying we need an axiological commitment to Yirat Shemayim and a complete preference for Torah study. And we have to follow the will of the Creator. And then ancillary secular studies will help us. But his first commitment even then was to Yirat Shemayim, Torah study, building the Torah personality, and secular only helping. And in fact, Rav Aaron always spent his time, whether here opening the kollel in the smicha program or in general building kollels. Secular studies did not play the major role in his worldview. He does talk about the Renaissance idea of being a well-rounded education, and his proof is Matthew Arnold, who talks about how those who were educated in Eton and Oxford can be true leaders of England, while those who went to polytechnic institutions can only be civil servants and generals, meaning those who try to study the true humanitarian education can be true leaders, while those people with small elements cannot be. Hold on. He also cites Newman's idea of the university, about the need for a broad range of disciplines. And his focus in all of these paragraphs, so I'm not going to take any questions yet, is how does it create leadership? I mean, it's very much the 19th century question of leadership of the British elite. At no point does he ever mention anything about American colleges or about American liberal arts. That's not what he's talking about. He does mention in an essay from the late 90s, when he talks about centrist orthodoxy, "I don't mean college per se," this is a quote, "much of what now passes in many places for collegiate education is little more than sophisticated plumbing. I am talking about the spiritual value of education." Okay, so he gives that general statement, but he doesn't enter into what it would actually take to convert a 1990s university or 1980s or 70s into anything he's talking about from the 1860s. He also says, you know, also paraphrasing Matthew Arnold, for a modern thing, is one should not choose lamb chops over the classics, meaning one should not choose to be a Philistine and vulgar materialism over an education. But once again, that was not the sort of choice, that's not the choice facing you at an 18-year-old. I mean, it's always phrased in terms of how to be a cultured individual. The example of how not to be a cultured individual, he usually gives some example of some conference that he went to with Haredi participants who had no historical or literary sense, and therefore it becomes a very black and white choice. Do you want to be one of those very simplistic and superficial Haredim that think that Moshe and the Chazon Ish were identical, or do you want to be a true champion of leadership? That's the way it usually gets set up, but at no point in this equation does he ever mention the academic disciplines like philosophy, history, sociology, science, psychology. It's always leadership, being able to make the right choices. One should not use a social or historic analysis, but one can, in studying Judaism, but one has to be the well thought out individual in order to apply things to your community. He repeats many a time, there are many places where our personal attitudes and the primary sources diverge, and he advocates submission, obedience, duty, and that the educated approach will help you in this process. So rather than saying whether Musar, Hasidus, correcting your actions will help you in this approach, he'll always say the well-thought-out general studies, ethical concerns, will help you lead the moral life. Yes, questions? Mr. Harrison.
Two things. I don't know what to do with it. The model is very strong, well-trained and highly cultured leadership.
Right. Okay, a lot of people have that thesis.
And the second thing is, you claimed once that he's looking at Jesus consumer culture. Is this current film about consuming culture, or saying it's about taking
the best? Let's get there. I said that about something else, and we're going to get there later in this class, not in this context. Yes?
Within Revolution of Marcia, are there any other examples for this bring in English literature?
No, it will be there for the explanation of how one should consider things, talk about things.
No, from the actual.
That's right.
And also, what was the reference used on study 33?
As far as he would say, there's nothing in our current canon that currently. I mean, he has it in the green volume of Judaism and Other Cultures, that he says whether it's art or literature or the Bhagavad Gita, there's nothing intrinsic. That's where our issue is. If you have, you know, practical Yirat Shemayim and commitment and belief in and belief in revelation, and you have all these prerequisites. But he just mentions it as one item as long as the list. I don't even think it's a full sentence on the topic.
And it's one that we can't, which might use a social or smart analysis.
Yeah.
Does that mean not with the job?
No, it means anything. You don't even use social analysis. You don't even use Parsons or Weber, or you don't use historic thinking. Yes.
Doesn't
he
favor literature over
brothers? 100%, big time.
That's just because he said that's a
yeah.
Comic.
Yeah, that's what he favored. But he all his examples come from literature. But he doesn't even talk about the field of literature. He talks about the great writings. Okay, which you're already pushing me forward into topics I'm going to get to. So please hold off. Okay, hold off. Because now he did his dissertation on the 17th century Cambridge Neoplatonists, and then the Cambridge Neoplatonists, like Henry Moore, argued for Platonism and against Descartes. They all argued against the isolated self of Descartes and modern science. And by extension, if you're following a Platonic worldview, you have very little use for Husserl or Heidegger or any modern thought that's not Platonic. The Cambridge Neoplatonists not only argued against the start of modern isolated consciousness, they also argued against medieval thought. Scholasticism and natural theology is not where it's at. So Ravaran tends to read the Ramban as a without his medieval elements. The Platonists were open champions of the truth of the mind and a clear thinking and analysis is going to offer truth. Now, this dissertation was done under the advisement of Professor Donald Bush, who even as last year of Aaron still called Maury Virabi. Now, Douglas Bush, unlike the rest of English in America, believed in a Christian humanism and that all literature must be morally uplifting and aesthetically pleasing. Professor Bush championed Renaissance literature over modern literature. Professor Bush believed in the Anglo-Catholic worldview and considered the Puritans as liberals because they were differing with the establishment. Bush was also a big believer in Matthew Arnold. And Rav Aaron, even at last year's Etzion Foundation dinner, did open up with somewhat of a paraphrase of one of Professor Bush's famous quotes. Which means Let's take this a step further. Rav Aaron is not reading what was in the 20th century. You will not find references to E. Cummings, Kafka, Proust, Joyce. You will not find Freud, Blake, and anything psychological. So no modernists, no psychology. You don't find the realism of a Dos Passos, a Steinbeck, a Lewis, a Sinclair, Lewis. You're not going to find symbolism. You will find a very specific canon of 19th century upper class British and 16th century Neoplatonists as his canon. It was not the modernist canon when he was in school. Okay? It's a big thing because many of his followers kind of confuse that point. As if he was already, that he was attempting some at using what was in the 1950s. No, in the 1950s, people were reading Kafka, Joyce, the modernist canon was coming to be. You know, if you want to see what was done in most college campuses, you look at someone like Professor Whitehorn's reading list. That's what was in during those decades. So there's a very clear chosen books to help a specific view of Torah. Rav Aaron also uses as ethical theory the writings of F.H. Bradley, who was a British Hegelian who believed that who took out all the technical parts of Hegel and said everybody has their duty in an organic society. Everyone has their station and their duty. Bradley. And Rav Aaron quotes that many points in his writings about the importance of understanding why we have to act in a realistic manner, why we have to serve in the army because that's our duty, why we have to do many things in the secular world because that is our duty. We don't live a life of hedonism. We live a life of duty. His views, whenever he talks about revelation and faith, he tends to rely on his readings of Gil Soane, a mid-20th century Catholic philosopher who believed that revelation triumphs over reason, and Thomas Aquinas believed in a divine command theory of revelation and not general reason. But Rav Aaron keeps coming back to the question of faith, and will also quote Coleridge on faith and many others, is that if that was this question of faith, and faith is faith itself, and that is a formulation in many, many of his writings about the need for understanding of faith in the will and wisdom of the divine. We don't start from human experience, we start from the will and wisdom of the divine. He also, in terms of his political theory, quotes many figures like T.H. Green, Burke, T.S. Eliot, who all advocated a conservative Christian state, or a state in which the government controls what you think and what you do. Very paternalistic, conservative state, because that's going to bring out the best in all people. Liberty does not get us anywhere. We must go somewhat down the Platonic road, as he says, in order for people to really maximize their potential. And this is now me speaking. This is the point, is that if he's quoting Bradley and T.S. Eliot and Green in late 20th century, as Professor Will Lee already corrected, every poli-sci course in America in the last 50 years has already taught the critiques of these figures by Karl Popper and Isaiah Berlin. So there's some element that his students just sat there and never realized that he was critiquing Locke, Mill, Hume, as was, and it's fine for him with his guidance under Professor Bush, but almost every one of his students no matter whether you took English with Professor Lee or poli-sci with Professor Bevan, you came out with a Isaiah Berlin, Karl Popper as victorious over these conservative thinkers. I mean, all courses were set up for a liberal state. None of these thinkers were ever seen as the heroes for any of our textbooks. So I actually said, originally said, mainly, he corrected me, he said, no, across the board, you're not going to find such a book in America that was written. So that's an important problem for the reception of Rivara's thought, because what does it now mean for people to be reading this and not know that this isn't the current American thought? It, one thing when you were dealing with modern orthodoxy and your Balabatim didn't go to college, so you could have gotten up there and said anything, as the philosopher said, and no one in a modern Orthodox congregation could ever call your bluff. But what does it now mean that since centrists all went to college, and many of them even have masters and doctorates, what does it now mean to be quoting some of the same literature that had been subject to many decades of critique without being aware of the critique of the of these ideas? And I don't have an easy answer for what that means. You know, how is it being read and received? Obviously, it's probably, the half an answer I can give you is that his writings are being read as Torah, and therefore we don't really bring in what we just read in Isaiah Berlin in order to strengthen or criticize it. Yes?
Are Lichtenstein's writings quoted within contemporary American?
No.
He didn't understand anything?
No. No. Okay.
Have the students read his work out of New York?
No, usually the joke in Yeshiva Har Etzion, and someone in Purim puts up Efshar LaHasig, you know, and they put up Chidushei HaRav Aharon, and then they put up a photocopy from his dissertation.
Well, somebody mentioned to me that he speaks in the dissertation like writes about the Lithuanian family model in the Salvation Network.
And
in his work on New York, he speaks about how there are certain trends which run throughout different generations. And he's trying to bring up the point that Henry Moore.
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
But it's pretty veiled, or
is he referring to politics? No, it's veiled.
Okay.
In terms of modern Jewish identity, he says there is a national identity, but it's not material or messianic like Rabkook says. It's more like Ernest Renan and Ernest Baker, our Victorian authors, tell us that a nation is a common general will, and our will is following the Torah. He rejects the need to do any defense of Orthodox Judaism before modernity. The Torah is permanent. There is no such thing as the American Jew, the modern Jew, the vanishing Jew. There is no modernity to accommodate. He quotes Max Weber's approving statement that Judaism is a traditional society that has an ethic different than the society that they live in, which means that he's openly disagreeing with Jacob Katz, who holds one of the definitions of modern orthodoxy is now the self-conscious orthodoxy, that you are now a modernist, you have to be a reverse, you have to be someone who's consciously modern and consciously adapting the world around you. He says, no, we are still living the traditional life of Eastern Europe. There has been no break. Zionism is not a break for him. In fact, you know, there's still assimilation because with Zionism. We serve in the army, like I said, only because of our sense of duty. In terms of authority, he argues for the need for gedolim. We can't, as a conservative thinker, we can't trust liberalism and autonomy. We must always trust authority, tradition, and revelation. meaning we need a gadol not unlike himself, who appreciates culture, secular studies, the human condition, and has a broad understanding of life. And that's how we should understand modernity, is that we don't have enough gadolim in the centrist camp anymore. It's not enough to submit ourselves to the text of the Rishonim for their authority, but we've got to submit to actual living gadolim. Rav Lichtenstein openly rejects Rav Hirsch, Rav Hoffman, and most of Western European Jewry, meaning everything we were doing in the traditionalist and modern Orthodox units, and even the Hirschian units, he really says is not coming from the Eastern European Beit Midrash. Okay. Now I'll take a question.
Does he miss the English? The
yes. Meaning which English rabbis?
Meaning.
How do you mean English literature? Meaning.
No, English.
No.
England.
No.
Okay.
They would not be coming from an Eastern European Beit Midrash.
Okay. And also, And also, where does he have comments on Lawrence Kaplan's article? At the forum or afterwards? Or
he clearly holds that there's a need for gadolim. He would not be accepting of that. It doesn't really matter that historic argument about where it's from. What's more important is the need for gadolim in our lives. Not the of course, once you're broadly educated, you know that gadolim can't predict historic events and cannot tell you everything about politics, but a Jew should live his life based on gadolim. What it's based on is his own worldview. Okay, yes.
Does Zervon use the term centrism, and if so, who does he apply it to?
He uses it. He likes the word centrism also, and it then becomes Anshei Shlomeinu. It becomes he applies it to Yeshivat Har Etzion and YU and all Orthodox form, Orthodox caucus, all these various institutions and everything. The RCA, he applies it to all of the above. Yes?
Can you just explain again the idea of Orthodoxy before modernity?
Yeah. Basically, he doesn't assume any rupture of enlightenment, emancipation, Zionism, assimilation. We have a continuous continuity of Gedolim studying Torah through the generations.
I don't understand why.
He doesn't put it, he actually has a very non-modernist definition. He assumes it's an eternal Platonic need to be well-educated. He doesn't think we do mada because of modernity. It is an eternal status. He's very much the Platonist. Judaism is eternal, and therefore we don't even ask historic questions about how much the Rambam knew or how much this one knew. That's just not what it's about. Yes.
I'm just going to keep repeating my old question, but I guess
now, if it's the same way, I'm not up to it yet.
No, but yeah. Not that question, but another old question, which is, we just had people who say philosophy is important and that's what I'm going to look at.
Yeah.
Now we have one guy who says that literature is really good and that's what we should look at.
Right.
Great books, and also Plato. What about history? Like, did nothing happen in the past?
The answer is okay. The answer is he does not like social science thinking to be applied to Judaism, to Chazal, to Halacha. That doesn't mean one can't study history. It is certainly important to know who won in Waterloo, and it's important to know about the Norman Conquest, and it's important to understand the rise of emancipation and the problematics of it. But halacha is to be understood as a eternal process, which the Baal Halacha uses the best available tools and to help formulate a halakhic worldview throughout all ages. So it's not the history is the problem, it's the historicism implicit within it.
And just quickly, what do you mean by that he rejected the German? Where does that show up? He just glosses over them?
He openly says, I question the role of Rav Hirsch and Rav Hoffman and others in our Masorah. He said that at several points. Okay, that's pretty explicit. Yes. He does that. He doesn't say openly, but it's implicit.
But is that meaning
that we remain at the same traditional ethic we've had since Rashi and the Rif till now.
Even though they
use Hegel's sentence? Well, we don't ask it in the external, in the historic point of view. Our Spaniards were much more cultured and used many more tools for more sophisticated worldview, while the Ashkenaz clearly had a more limited canon, and there are many aspects that we relate to less because of its less breadth. But obviously, as we told you before, the same way in the Haredi community, there are many issues they can't deal with as well compared to us. It would reapply here, but that's far from historicism. That's assuming there's an eternal question we keep coming back to.
So how do you view within the Haredi camp?
Who are you? What are you thinking of? Here, there, where? Let me answer it differently. If the answer is he had was on best of terms with Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, which was the world of Rav Yashiv and company, he was part of it. He clearly showed cover to it. He was respected. The Hesder movement clearly, unlike here, where they slope between various forms of Haredi yeshiva all the way down to modern orthodoxy, there it's either you did tzava or you didn't do tzava is a bigger break. Rav Aaron is clearly on the tzava mamachti dati side, but he had connections throughout his life to the Gedolim, and even beforehand, he grew up in a world connected to the Gedolim.
And about Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and the Israeli scene,
yeah.
How does he contrast with, let's say, Professor Sperber and his historic?
He would think it's illegitimate.
And merely academic?
No, it's illegitimate on many levels.
Has he ever?
Yes. It's illegitimate on many, many levels, that whole approach. But when we talk about the Israeli approaches, we can do that more. Okay. Okay, in terms of dealing with his father-in-law of Soloveitchik, he says he really questions his father-in-law's connecting lumdus with autonomy and individuality. He believes more in a theocentric system than his father-in-law's anthropocentrism. He believes in a theocentric worldview, while his father-in-law was more anthropocentric, and he questions needing to link autonomy to lumdus.
How do you do
that? That's a question of the Rav. Let's not... Okay, try reading the Rav. Also, where the Rav talks about commitment and personal decision making, that existential language, you will not see that in Rav Aaron. That was noted by many long before me. He does talk about how his father-in-law was a very creative, and how his father-in-law was on the outs with the yeshiva world. He's willing to acknowledge that. He wants to say that Rav Soloveitchik was a literary artist and a poet and not an abstract neo-Kantian, and he thinks that the Rav's neo-Kantianism is just all abstruse abstractions that were really unneeded. meaning Rav Aaron does not need a philosophic explanation of halacha. He accepts from the Rav the humanistic model that Reb Chaim of Brisk was this great ethical figure, helping people, and that's who we should use as our role model that the Rav presents. So in that he's very much like Rav Schachter. They both use that Rav's image of Reb Chaim. On many issues, because of his upbringing and his own inclination, he'll set himself up as, Rav Huttner said this, he's not going to do it by name, but he'll give a position that's Rav Huttner's, Rav Dessler's, or the Chazon Ish, as his point, when he's differing with, meaning his Baal Plugta in many an essay is a Rav Huttner, you know, one could say, and it's always from the yeshiva point of view. His Bar Plukta is never a modern Orthodox thinker. It's always a yeshiva thinker. And with that, Rav Lichtenstein is a very sharp critic of anything that the Datiyim HaChadashim talk about, whether, like, for example, Rav Sherlo, their eclecticism, their individuality, their historicism, their liberalism. They're willing to bring all these things out. He's very sharp about it.
He openly
last year, even at, it was really interesting, last year at the Etzion Foundation dinner, he got up and ended his talk with a diatribe against it and these new Ramim, and nobody in these Americans knew. There were like five of us in the room who knew what he was referring to, because all the people who live in who are now professionals in the burbs, you know, have not really, they're not up on what Rav Sherlo and Rav Bigman and Rav Shigar are writing, and so the entire screed was wasted.
So Rav Sherlo was criticized by Shapiro from America's Rav.
Let's wait till we get to the Datiyim HaChadashim to answer the specifics of who's doing what.
Right.
Let's limit this to the Rav Aaron points. In the last couple of years, he's written letters critiquing Eda and all modernist agenda that came out in the Forward. Okay, maybe we'll put that up on the site too. We'll put some more stuff up. He wrote letters in 2001, Haaretz, against Yishai Rosenzweig and any sense of conscientious objection, because it's your duty to serve. So therefore, even if you're serving during the Intifada and the Shtachim, you should greet each Palestinian with respect and dignity and ethical, universal ethical concern. And the response of Yishai Rosenzweig was, that's not the way things work, Hashetach. That's not what it means to be a soldier if you have to police in that. What? Yigal Amir, on the other hand, he comes out against all the other heads there, Ramim, and on both the investigation of Saba and Shatila, and Yigal Amir and Baruch Goldstein, he came out with the correct universal ethic, Lo Tirzach. No. No. That's right. That's right. He doesn't have to. He acknowledges that his theory is a bit elitist, and he realizes that when a time when most of Klal Yisrael does not as they Shema, is it the right approach? And he says, well, that's the approach that I'm going to take. And I think it's still the best approach, even with its difficulties. And that's the other major theoretician of centrism. Okay, now we turn to, yes.
But
we turn to the Torah Mada problem now, yes. Right. I'm not sure I'm following. Meaning, I understand the dichotomy you're making, the rub between his drashot and his halakhic analysis.
So for Rav Aaron, does that a similar dichotomy exist for him?
Does a similar
dichotomy... Is everything as plugged into his understanding of halakha?
No. There are clearly things, but for example, the fact that he dances Friday night. A lot of his aspects of frumkeit are don't fit into his... You know, there are things like that, but he's not going to, every one of his drushot are ideologically charged.
But he's not into modern philosophy, he's not into the psychological.
No. That's part of the point, is that, but unlike, the point is not because he's, you know, he's clearly thinking that the Torah view of Gedolim, whether it's Marzutra or Bahrami Rutenberg, or it's the Brisker Rav, is supported by those Victorians and not supported by Freud or any psychological read. Tennessee Williams will not help him in his task. You know, and when now we get to the Torah Mada point, is there many who will then misconstrue him, ki'ilu, he's, you know, using everything. When no, he clearly wants to make a Torah viewpoint. Yes?
Two things. How come Victorian model, correct, one that a later, that 20th century American literature isn't?
Because in 20th century mid-American literature tends to be individualistic, liberal, psychological, conflicted.
So the group is the fact that these are just traditional Torah.
That's right.
That 20th century doesn't have that.
I mean, did you read E. Cummings growing up in high school?
Yeah.
E. Cummings, you know, old age puts up signs, youth takes them down. That sort of like basic sentence, those things, almost any of the American literature is an incredible individualist, whether Jack London or anyone else, it's an individualism.
Yeah. And I'll, aside from the letters, does he take a stand regarding
Yes, he has a series of articles on centrism. Well, the truth is, a lot of what he says, a lot of what he does, he still came back to the Orthodox form every year, and most of his writings were formulated for an American audience.
Does he say that the Israeli audience is seeking to?
Well, that's part of the problem that 4 years ago he had. That's 4 years ago. Everyone jumped to go to Rav Sherlo and Rav Shigar and Rav Bigman rather than going to Alon Schwartz, and therefore the goal is now to Yeshiva Har Etzion is to deal with that issue. Okay. Good. They are people who have fallen away from the Torah. He's not coming from an American, pulpit perspective. They don't exist. They really don't exist in his world. That's a very important point. They're really not there. Yes?
He said that he's conscious of the difficulties in his approach.
Yeah.
And yet, like, you keep saying that he's making statements that he's appointed.
Yes.
So, has he ever actually dealt with the dichotomy where he had the economy as an art,
The answer that I'm going to give you is a different sort of answer. Is, for one thing, you're thinking demographics, which is not his way of thinking. But he knows there are other Darchei Halimud besides the conceptual one. Yes, 2 days ago, he actually walked up to someone here and asked about their son who doesn't want to learn conceptual and wants to learn in a more historic way. Have you found the yeshiva for him? He knows there are other derachim on a personal level who talk like that. I can have a great conversation with him over lunch. Okay? But whenever he gets up and speaks publicly or writes, it becomes very categorical. The person is much more dynamic than the writings and speeches are all categorical. And the answer is, if you ask him what about the other approaches, he will say, this is the one that I think fits best. Well, I understand someone can make an argument for the others. He will point to people. Meaning he will point, and I'll take it just an example, I'm not going to make a big issue of this. He can point to, for example, his son, Moshe, who would fulfill his requirements. Okay, now the Torah Umada problem. Okay, a book came out by President Lamb 15 years ago based on lectures that were originally given in the 80s. I mean, so this was after he handled the bankruptcy problem, and in the 80s he started giving lectures, and that produced this volume. And his view of, he quotes President Revel about synthesis. He'll quote many people, and I'll say everyone in modern Orthodoxy is all about Torah Umada. But I did, unfortunately, since we're all talking the same thing, for some reason that he can't explain, they're not dealing with his problems. Well, they're not answering his questions. He says that this is a perennial issue. It's always been Jews lived among pagans, they lived among Christians, they lived among Muslims. It's a perennial question about Torah Umada. And on page 6, he uses a phrase, a synergistic interrelationship of religious study and sacred or profane knowledge. Okay? That's his working definition. It is, no, but the choice of words there are synergistic interrelation of religious study and secular or profane knowledge. He will talk about this. Many people who've been did this before Yeshiva University, Philo in Greeks in ancient Alexandria in Greek times, the Rishonim in Spain, the Maharal, Rav Rinus, they were all forerunners of Yeshiva University. But he then focuses on the Yavne movement in Telz and Vilna, and how Revel really was coming out of the Yavne Torah Umada movement. His second chapter is opposition to Torah Umada, and in this he brings back a lot of the critiques of Torah Umada. He will say, look, the Chassam Sofer rejected Torah Umada. Now in America, the Debrecina Rav thinks it's us to have anything to do with Yeshiva University. Satmar will reject Torah Umada. But as Eliezer Berkowitz taught us, we can't be the Nitzuri Carter of the world. They claim the Torah Umada's heresy, Bittul Torah, and we have to be limited to the Dalet Amos of Halacha. And the Balei Musar that we all read in Yeshiva also told us this. But no, we have to go forward. Part of the problem with this book is, unfortunately, he did a better job presenting the world of the Torah of Adas that he came from than his vision of what he wanted YU to be. Because he collected all the criticisms and he put them first. And usually you do that when you put criticisms, you put them, you know, kla'achar yad, backhandedly in the last chapter. He put the criticisms up front, thinking this volume was going to be a direct frontal attack on them. Now let me just go through his frontal attack. He deals with models of Torah Umada. The first one is the rationalist one that he associates with the Rambam. But since we can't do medieval philosophy or science anymore, What the Rambam really teaches us is the need to read secular literature, not any specific statements. He then spent over half the chapter on the Rambam rejecting the idea of Hitkatnu Hadarot, that generations have gotten less, because if the Rambam did science for his time, we have to do science and philosophy for our time. So he spends the chapter answering why we don't have to do Hitkatnu Hadarot and why do we don't have to listen to the Rambam's medieval worldview. But at the same time, he would now be the Rambam becomes a general term for all rationalism. He then turns to Hirsch for the next chapter, in which he first presents all the Eastern European critiques of Rav Hirsch, all the Rav Baruch Baer's critiques. And he says, yes, many critiqued it even in Western Europe as a schizoid personality. He tells over all the critiques of Torah Derech Eretz from the 1910 through 1940, all the stuff that Mordechai Breuer collected. But he says that the Hirschian approach is not enough Torah. And he says on page 124, insofar as Torah Derech Eretz is a theory is concerned, Torah Umada shares with it to a greater extent than it diverges from it. And that's going to be very revealing. In some level, he knows he's a Hirschian in Torah Derech Eretz, but what his goal of the rest of the book is to answer the Eastern European criticisms of Bittul Torah, Dalet Amos, Halacha, and the being schizoid. With that, he turns in the next chapter to Rav Kook. It's his first way of answering up this. And his presentation of Rav Kook is the Rav Kook of the pulpit rabbi, the old pulpit rabbi, American pulpit rabbis. So it's Rav Kook who wants to renew the old and sanctify the new. So therefore, the need to go out and go out into the modern world. And Rav Kook had a real tension and synthesis. But Rav Kook wanted to make everything into Kodesh. But we already see from Rav Kook that it's not Bittul Torah, and we don't have to say Dalet Amos and Halacha and heresy can be fruitful. So he's, and that's the way the book is set up to answer up the yeshiva critics. His next three chapters are only 3-4 pages each. They're an interlude before his final chapter. He deals with the tension between Chassidut and Mitnagdut, and sees that there are many like Hasidim and Kabbalists who appreciate the natural world, unlike Misnagdim. So we're not just Dalet Amos of Halacha. He talks about the Mitnagdim teaching us the need for using secular knowledge to understand Torah. He then talks about a textless Torah, in which he translates the philosophy and Kabbalah of the Rambam and the Gra into a more allegorized, genetic need for rationality and appreciating the world. And then finally he concludes with his Hasidic model, where he says studying Mada is an avoda. So we've already seen from Rav Kook and Hasidus that not everything is Talmud Torah, it's not Bittul Torah, and therefore we're going to do secular studies as an avoda. He gives a little Yehi Ratzon, you can say, before your secular classes. God wants us to go to college. God wants us to embrace the world in order for wholeness, shlemus, understanding, rationality. And he thinks that this Hasidic model of going to college because God wants us to. How do we know God wants us to? Because let's review. Rav Kook told us we can grapple with heresy and we can make the secular Kodesh. Chassidut told us to appreciate nature. Mitnagdim told us we can use the Torah in an instrumental way. And there's a textless Torah of Rambam's study. I mean, he takes the Rambam's Masa Bereshit, Masa Merkava, and instead of saying that they're Sodot Torah, he says that they're really secular studies. And therefore, all of the yeshiva critique falls away. No questions until I give you my comments on this. Now, the problem with this setup is that, one, it was very unquantified. Very, very unquantified. What did you mean by secular studies? He encouraged and was very happy with the business school, did not do anything to encourage liberal arts here, and spent most of his time increasing Kollel's Torah study here. Because the goal was, now you're going to be a well-rounded Kollel student who's exposed to secular studies. Secular studies were never quantified. Two, he'll have open lines that were just counterfactual. Like, unlike the rest of the world that doesn't see a need for liberal arts anymore, we at Yeshiva see an ever greater need for liberal arts. And he wrote an editorial to the New York Times about the importance of liberal arts, and we would never cut it at Yeshiva. Even as he was doing drastic cuts, and even as he was doing the exact curriculum revision that was going on at many other campuses. He also claimed that, unlike other business programs that don't require liberal arts, we require a healthier dose. In fact, most business schools require more liberal arts than Yeshiva College, and Yesai Sims actually requires less than half of Baruch or Pace of liberal arts. And in general, Mada generally meant going out into the professions and the real world. It never really had any academic grounding to it. Which gives us a problem that this book took three giant steps forward, but nobody followed, and instead took us five steps backwards. Meaning, the three giant steps forward, if people had listened, would have been secular studies are now to be done lishma, meaning like many a 19th century modernist Christian, like Cardinal Newman, we are going to, or Schleiermacher, we are going to college and studying liberal arts lishma. His second major step forward was liberal arts are going to be our avoda. Very Protestant way of thinking. Liberal arts are going to be the new avoda. Third step forward is, he said, we have to create new types of people, new shleimut, new innovations. However, this book took then five steps backwards, because one, the answer that he gave was so bold, what most people were left with now putting the Eastern European critique back on the table, in which the modern Orthodox didn't have it. Rabbis Wurzberger and Rackman never cared about the Eastern European critique of secular studies. The critiques are now back on the table. Two. What? Yeah. Two, to speak about liberal arts as worship is not a real college life. Meaning it was never grounded in any way that was real for most students here. Three, he never realized it in the practical realm by putting emphasis on it. In fact, during most of his tenure, YU was either a two-year college and then became a three-year business school, but it certainly was not giving more time to Mada. Four, he openly rejected the intellectualism of the Rambam, the Gra, and says, we're not that intellectual. we're more devotional, which is an approach that already, because your biggest Torah Madaniks up on the fifth floor of the library are going to be the intellectuals. He's taking a more devotional approach. Finally, he placed himself on a defensive on the need to justify his positions. And not only did he then involve himself in terms of his attacks back and forth with the right-wing world, he also got himself involved even within the yeshiva, him versus Rav Schechter, him versus Rav Kahn, who really took issue with this. And so it really became President Lamb versus the Rosh Yeshiva, versus certain Rosh Yeshiva for most of his stay here. So it was three steps forward and it wound up becoming five steps back. And NYU wound up becoming less modern in the end. Yes. I still want to talk about the Torah Mada Journal and Jewish history and all such other things. So
the Judaism and Catholic and other culture.
Yes.
Volume of that to be considered a further expansion of Berlin's Torah Mada for historical. The grand first use of the quotes, I think there are Lewis Song and Jarvis, he gave five sources. In Jarvis and Darker, he goes into.
Okay, so the answer is that volume took a long time to write. There are many footnotes through more than half of the authors that take issue with this book. So as much as it was conditioned, it wound up, once you started turning historic and theoretical, this book did not hold up as well. You know, Rav Aaron is very polite. He just put a one footnote. You know, I have never seen evidence for a textless Torah, but I know there are those out there who use that phrase. You know, it had that sort of, it helped him less, it helped less than you would think.
And then also, the idea of showing the 1910s, 1940s piece of Torah Mada, is that something, we're probably here about this in Torah Mada, but that our chapter writes in is very sorry.
It became the major issue. But already, rather than a modern Orthodox, you're on the offensive. You've now gone on the defensive. You've conceded too much ground. You've now playing on somebody else's side.
And one last thing. He
says that
the thing
that
differentiates modern Orthodox from the very world of five things.
Yes. Okay. So this.
Right. So. Is that an example of he's not trying to be on the defensive?
100% on the defensive. 100% on the defensive.
Right.
So if we, that's exactly where. So you're making me jump ahead. So I'm going to hold off questions till at least for the next minutes, because I don't find that was a rather productive series of questions at all. The first issue of the Torah Umada Journal in 84. Already in the very first issue, more than half of the authors were against Torah Mada. Now, if someone wanted a strong arm belief, push the idea forward, you would have editorially rejected it. The strong article of the first article of Torah Mada Journal was by Walter Wurzberger, defending the need for modernity. But it included articles by Rav Parnas outright calling it heresy, by Rabbi Willig saying, are they for everybody? You've got to evaluate your Parnassa situations. Rabbi Blau talking about it as a question of career choice. And Rabbi Rosenzweig talking about the role of secular studies in one's avodas Hashem and Shir. A Rav Aaron Lichtenstein sort of position. In fact, the first issue came out with very little defense of Torah Mada and actually a much stronger critique. Volume 2, on the other hand, had a strong response to Rav Parnas by Larry Kaplan and David Berger, showing that the Rambam did for his age and we respond for our age. And of course, we're not going to study Aristotle and Avicenna, and we're not going to study Sodot. We study our modern philosophy and the letter to Ibn Tibbon that the Rambam believed in studying Aristotle and Farabi and others. It will include an article by Rav J.J. Schechter saying, look, the yeshiva world is wrong. The Lashon wasn't closed over secular studies. Therefore, we can claim the Eastern Europeaners as ours. Because when, remember, they studied Russian for an hour and a half a week in another building, and so therefore they accepted secular studies, so therefore they're not, the yeshiva world is wrong. Not what? And the article by Rabbi Karmi on the need for Yirat Shemayim when you use secular studies, whose major goal we'll see is trust the rabbis, not the professors. So Torah Mada shifted into now an activity of rabbis who are engaged in majoring in philosophy and then do a Rebbe Masters and hang out and talk. It no longer meant confronting fields that are out there. It meant that Larry Kaplan, David Berger, Shalom Karmi, J.J. Schechter are the models for Torah Mada. No longer do we have Saul Roth getting up there and saying science is an autonomous realm and I trust Bertram Russell, Ayer, Einstein, Bohr for science. Torah Mada now becomes an activity for certain rabbis to do. Volume 3 was almost entirely on science. Very much orthodox scientist approach. The only exception in Volume 3 was Moshe Bernstein's article on Bible, dealing with the issues of doing Bible as orthodoxy. And Volume 4 continues science, except for an article that grew into a book by Mark Shapiro, dealing with Are the 13 Ikara and the Last Words, and that took on its own life. But it clearly was not playing in. I mean, once again, with the first four issues, and we still haven't gotten anything that played into defending the book Torah Mada in the Torah Mada journal. We then come to the Torah Mada book started to receive critiques in Jewish Observer, by among other people, the Yonason Rose. What's his name? Rosenblum, who wrote a devastating attack on the book. Rav Elias writing an attack on the whole approach. And Rav Twersky writing an attack, which then got a response from Rabbi Lamb himself. So Meir Schiller's defense of this book, so in the end what we're going to have is throughout the entire decade, the only one rising to the defense of this is going to be Meir Schiller from MTA. What? Okay. In which... But that already says a lot about the dynamics and why it was so problematic. It's because none of the obvious candidates came and defended it.